Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by our tactics guy and spreadsheet nonce, Nathan A. Clark.
That's a good one. That might be the best one, yeah.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good, because you tweeted a spreadsheet.
I've tweeted two spreadsheets in like a 12-hour spread, so you can tell the season is over already.
Okay, I knew one of them because you ran it past me. What was the other one?
Yeah, oh, the other one was much more noncey. The other one was a breakdown of points games, points per game, expected points per games, and a projection of points per games and expected points per games if they were to be dragged out over the course of the season, breaking it down into time this season under Pochettino, time this season under Mourinho pre-lockdown, time this season under Mourinho post-lockdown, and all time under Mourinho. And basically our expected points have been consistently the same throughout as our results have varied.
I really, really want to see the spreadsheet. I'm off Twitter for 48 hours in solidarity with my Jewish friends and followers. But I really want to see that spreadsheet because I actually included something in the running order about just this, around the discussions that are ongoing about where we would be under Mourinho. But let's come back to that. Firstly, I just want to give a quick shout out to a man by the name of Mike Smith, very nice man by the name of Mike Smith. I've been working with him on some artwork for my other podcast, which I've mentioned, 50 Minutes with Flav and Windy. And he's made me this awesome cover photo as well for my Twitter, which I will be uploading as soon as I'm back on that platform. And I kind of just wanted to say thanks to Mike and also recommend him for anyone who might need a designer. He's really easy to work with. He's a fantastic designer. You can look at his work on mikesmithdesign.co.uk. And yeah, make sure you tell him you came from the Extra Inch podcast if you choose to use him. But highly recommend Mike. He's lovely and he's great. All that aside, Crystal Palace happened. I don't really remember a great deal about the game, to be honest, Nathan. And the reason for that is I kind of lost interest in it, and I was basically pissing about on my phone for at least half of it, I think. How did you find it?
Yeah, my experience wasn't dramatically different, considering like how much was on the line. How, like, if Palace had scored at any minute, it could have had a significant... It was also, like, pretty difficult to watch. Yeah. I was watching the Chelsea-Wolves game on a different screen at the same time and switching back and forth. And, yeah, I don't know. The first half was all right. There's a video I've just seen that was on the subreddit where it's 68 minutes and it's Mourinho finding out the Chelsea score. And Dele is warming up. He's ready to come on. And he finds out the Chelsea score and he immediately goes over to Dele and says, "No, stay there. Stay there for a few more minutes. Oh. This game is shut down. A draw is fine."
That makes sense. I remember telling. It was around the drinks break, right?
Yeah.
Just before the drinks break started. I remember him, I could see him saying something over and over again. I couldn't work out what he was saying, but perhaps it was Dele, Dele, Dele. And he was probably calling him to say, you know, "Don't worry, you're not going on."
Yep.
Intriguing. Okay. I mean, that makes so much sense. Because it was peak Jose Mourinho in the second half, wasn't it? Like you said, the first half was fine. I thought there was some good stuff, some bad stuff, but the goal from Kane was great.
Yeah.
Really, really enjoyed that
good pressing
touch and finish.
As well in the lead up to that, I thought.
Yes.
We pressed very high, all of us, and won the ball as well, you know. That's... And not only won the ball high, but immediately transitioned to an effective attack after winning the ball high. You know, that's good stuff. And then that was basically it for the whole game. But That's what you get.
Lo Celso got an assist, which will keep certain sections of our fan base quiet, I guess. I mean, it's worth talking about this briefly, I think, because I think Lo Celso, because we lost Eriksen and Lo Celso came to the fore, people see him as an immediate replacement for Eriksen, and he's really, really not. He's just not that kind of player. I mean, even if he's playing the same positions, I don't think he's going to be playing the same passes. Go on, disagree with me.
Well, you know, we've lost our playmaker and we've replaced him with another, you know, creative playmaker type. I guess he's going to be playing less sort of line breaking passes and crosses than Eriksen was, but it's a very similar role. Assists are part of his job. He has two now. He's putting up 0.1 expected assists per 90, which is at the lower end of what you're looking for a playmaker. It's sort of the floor. Yeah. And considering how many games he's played in the central midfield role, you can give him a bit of leeway with that. But yeah, he's you know, he's not had an outstanding chance creation season, but he's been our, you know, primary chance creator in the second half of the season. You know, the level that we're playing at and the level that we're creating at means that he's not going to be a statistical standout, but he is. It's not as simple as to say assists aren't his job. Assists are one of the many facets of his job. But also assists are freaky and weird, and you can put up chance after chance after chance to get no assists, or every time you accidentally fall over the ball, the next player could bang it in for you and you end up with 20 assists in a season. The assists are such, there is so much variance around assists that the actual assist figure is essentially useless. But he's creating a chance and a half, two chances a match, and that is part of his job, and he has been doing that despite all of the circumstances that limit that for him.
That's totally fair enough. I see him as way more of a do-it-all midfielder than Eriksen ever was.
Sure.
And so I will judge him as something between Modric and Eriksen rather than Eriksen, if that makes sense, because I think he's doing a lot of the work rate stuff that Eriksen just never did, and we didn't ask him to do, and it was fine that he didn't do that. Well, it's not true. He worked. Eriksen was a worker in terms of his pressing and cutting off passing lanes, but he wasn't kind of making tackles and interceptions in midfield and then playing vertical passes forward that then lead to someone and then created something. And I personally think we're sort of transitioning away from having a creative hub in the team towards having a workman-like midfield and a front three that create for themselves, a bit like Liverpool in the sense. Except Liverpool have got the added bonus of having really good fullbacks that create too. But they haven't got a midfielder that is particularly creative.
No, but Liverpool are the exception because of the way that they play. And then on top of that, yes, the sort of outrageous crossing game of both fullbacks at the same time. I don't. This is an argument that I see quite a bit where, you know, where I talk about a team needs a playmaker and people say, well, Liverpool don't have one, but other teams don't play like Liverpool do. A couple of teams play a bit like Liverpool do, but most teams don't, and we certainly don't. I don't know, can you get by without a creative player if you just play like a medium block and counter game? Probably not. I think if you look back through Mourinho's history, he's always had a creative player in his team because, you know, you want someone to play that ball over there. You look like, especially Fabregas, his last title win, playing that ball over the top of Costa all the time. I mean, yeah, you know, I think that's just the way it is. And I do think that Lo Celso is, yeah, he's more like, he's, you know, on the Modric to Eriksen scale, he's a little over halfway towards Modric. Modric puts up 0.16 expected assists per match over the course of all of his Real Madrid seasons. So, you know, if he's that type of player, then he's sort of, he's in line with that, you know?
Yeah, this is sort of the conversation we were having over WhatsApp during the match as well. I feel like, I mean, I agree, basically, Lo Celso is our best playmaker, undoubtedly, but I don't think he's being used as a playmaker. And I think the way that Mourinho is setting us up will mean that we're not going to see him make chance after chance after chance, because, frankly, we don't have the possession to do that anyway. Like, if he becomes a really efficient playmaker who, when he gets like one or two chances to make a pass and makes it, then great. But I can't see him creating in the same way that Eriksen did, where we had so much possession and he could take more chances because we'd get the ball back and you'd get another go. That's not really us anymore. We've got to be more ruthless. And also, Lo Celso is playing a little bit more deep than Ericsson did under Pochettino. So I don't think it's comparing apples with apples. I think it's slightly different. But I agree that Lo Celso can play make and is our best playmaker as it stands. I think Ndombele could become like just as good a playmaker given a shot. It is interesting. I mean, it's partly the effect of Mourinho's tactics and partly the nature of the player, I think. And Lo Celso also, let's remember that he's played a variety of different roles throughout his career. He's played the deep midfield kind of combative role, and he's played the role as a number 10, and he's played off the right. And I guess you could say the same for Eriksen. He played on the left a fair bit before he moved into the centre, but he never played that kind of combative midfield role. And that's not because Lo Celso is not good at playing as a 10, so he got moved back. It's that he's really good at playing as an 8, so he got moved back. So it's a testament to him having good all-round ability, I guess. Was there anything from the Palace game that was notable to you, Nathan, in terms of our tactics or style?
We didn't play lopsided fullbacks. Ben Davies got up and down the line a little bit, which is a bit of a trend we've seen over the last few weeks, that maybe we're moving away from that, or maybe we want to use that more sparsely so it's a little harder to prepare for. Or maybe we're preparing to not be playing with Ben Davies and Serge Aurier. Let's see how that goes.
My theory on that is that since Winks came back into the team and played as the deepest line midfielder, he's dropped occasionally into the back three to get us started. And I wonder whether that might be why Davis has been a little higher. I was really surprised when I saw the average position charts to see Davis kind of higher up the pitch than I anticipated. He was nowhere near like the left-sided centre-back essentially that I expected. But you're right, it's because recently we've transitioned towards a more orthodox setup. Sorry, were you going to say something then?
This is me being pedantic, completely unnecessary. But average position charts are based on, or normally whenever I see them, are based on touches. And where you have your touches is not necessarily where you are. That's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant because it shows that Davies was where he was. But I can't help but hear a mention of an average position chart without being
That's a useful clarification, to be honest. Really useful clarification.
Because you'll often see especially recently for Spurs, you're like average position chart, and then Harry Kane is underneath the centre backs or whatever. Yeah. And it's why is he playing there? It's he's not. That's just he's getting most of his touches in the beginning of counter attacks rather than where he's actually stood. And heading away corners, yeah, exactly.
Which he's really good at.
Yeah.
Palace I thought were better than I expected. Partly because we were quite passive and happy just to defend our penalty area, and so they had a bit more space to work with. But I thought Jeff Schlupp played really well. I thought their young left back played well. They certainly offered more thrust than I expected, and
I was surprised they cared.
Yeah, exactly. That was it. It was that kind of typical last ever season match where you expect the kind of on the beach approach from a team who's got nothing to play for. But to be fair to them, Ayew had a really good game, and the Schlupp I thought was good, and they were fine. They outplayed us for much of the game. Would you agree?
It's we controlled the game without controlling the ball, and Palace aren't going to create many situations against set defensive sides, so
yeah,
we allowed them to have the ball, didn't we?
And that was certainly the case. They created chances, but none of them were sort of gilt-edged chances.
Sure.
And one of them was probably about right on balance of play, I would say. But it kind of did what we needed to do. And Mourinho was celebrating at the end. What did you make of that? The big ring of coaching staff.
He loves that. He loves the performative joy thing. I remember him doing that when United won the Charity Shield or whatever, where he's he deliberately makes a big thing of what he knows is what he's previously disparaged as a minor thing. And then it's therefore he's loudly broadcasting the message that I have succeeded. This is a success. This is not to be doubted as anything other than a really good thing. You can tell because I'm jumping up and down with joy.
Yeah. I mean, opposition fans would certainly say small club mentality, wouldn't they? Celebrating qualifying for the Europa League. But when you look back over where we've come from, it's difficult to argue that it hasn't been a success.
It is a success. Yeah. It absolutely is. But it's the fact that he has to do the big show of the success that's funny.
Yeah. Nathan, what have you made of the post-restart Premier League?
It was better than I thought it would be.
Mm.
And, it was better than I thought it would be in terms of product and in terms of, you know, no games being cancelled, no, like, large numbers of a squad falling ill, etc., etc. So, again, my other sport is mixed martial arts, and they've been continuing on. They started back again a month or two earlier than football did. They didn't have much of a break at all. And about half their roster is American, and a lot of them are Brazilian, and a lot of the cards, not recently, but initially took place in the US. So they had a lot of cancellations because players kept contracting the virus and coaches kept contracting the virus and things had to be cancelled. And we didn't really see... There was something earlier on with Brighton where they were talking about pulling out or delaying or weren't able to train. And there were a couple of earlier cases, but we pretty much cleaned up pretty fast and got into good situations and handled things. I mean, there are a lot of like blokes standing around in corridors with like masks under their chin. It was, I mean, we won't know till later on. We probably never know if what impacts, if any, it all had. But it was safer than I was expecting, based on what we know so far.
Yeah, I agree. I agree entirely. I'm pleasantly surprised by how well planned and managed the whole thing was in terms of what we could see. I mean, I know when we spoke to Alex for the two Project Restart podcasts, he had concerns about the testing process, and rightly so, because they sounded very flimsy from everything we knew. But from the stuff that you could see on your TV screen, it looked really well done. And the fact that, like you say, there've been minimal outbreaks, that kind of implies that things have gone well as they planned it to. And so it's really pleasing. I've really enjoyed having football back. It's been a very welcome distraction for the end of lockdown. The frequency of games has suited me perfectly. I know it's not ideal for the players, but it's been really lovely to have that kind of match to look forward to every two or three days. So that's been great. I'm intrigued now to see how soon the season restarts. It's scheduled to start in about 3 weeks, I think, which is crazy, but I'm sure it'll be pushed back a little bit further.
So it's 7 weeks from now as it stands, and
right.
Europa League is so if Chelsea win the FA Cup, then we are through to the group stage. But if that lot down the road win, then we are in the qualifiers, and the qualifiers are in like 3 or 4 weeks, which is insane.
Yeah, but there's scope for that to be pushed back, I suspect.
You reckon?
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see. It's the players won't necessarily need a long break because they've already had one, but at the same time, there'll be transfer business and clubs will want a break, I'm sure. I'm sure they'll want a break. So we'll wait and see. Any other observations about the post-restart football, particularly in terms of the use of substitutions or the style of football generally?
Well, I think it's really suited us and Mourinho and the way that he likes to play. I think that so something that we talked about before, we talked about tactical periodization and rotation and such, and the way that Mourinho plays a slower, less demanding, less physically demanding version of football, less combative version of football, means that we wouldn't have to, like, you know, players can play twice in a week, essentially, for us. And that is less the case for other sides. We've seen a lot of, like, especially right at the beginning, like, we saw that Arsenal game where they, like, 7 players went down with muscle injuries or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. And that has really suited our ability to, especially, like, the last few games, just grind out that same 11 week after week after week, get some subs in at the end, just for a bit of rest. And, it's really suited us, and it's really suited... I mean, it's curious, like, is this how Mourinho wants us to play next season, or is this what he did for just post-lockdown football? And I think I could definitely go either way, because it makes a lot of sense to say, okay, you know, I'm going back to old school Mourinho just for this, because it's going to work in these conditions, and it really did. Because I think pre-lockdown he was trying something more expensive, more expansive, more modernised, more like what we were doing before. So it'll be interesting interesting. It'll be very, very interesting to see what comes next. I do suspect, or I'm certainly open to the idea, that that was just what we wanted to do for now, to get through things and, you know, climb our way up to sixth doing it. So fair play.
I think that's a very reasonable takeaway, but the only argument I would have against that is that if you were doing what you just described, I don't think he'd be shy in telling the cameras that. I don't think he'd be shy in telling the press conferences, you know, football's different now, so we have to adjust to that. And he's been quite coy on that, from what I can tell. He's not really spoken about. He has spoken about developing a style and coaching the squad and having a long period with the squad together for the first time. My suspicion is it's probably that's just the way we're going to play now. But I mean, time will tell.
Let me dream.
Yeah, yeah. No, please do, because you need to. You need to, because it's, you know, if yeah, we've had this conversation before, but that game against Crystal Palace was pretty much unwatchable at times. It was not pretty. We got the result we needed. This is the thing. And there are plenty of fans who are very happy with that. And that's cool. Like, there's different ways to appreciate football and we all want different things. And that's absolutely fine. I wouldn't like to see a season of that. I really wouldn't like to see a season of that. However, I mean, it's difficult to argue against the results, isn't it? He's kind of done what he needed to do to get us as high up the table as he could. And he's kind of achieved beyond probably what we expected, certainly just pre-lockdown. We were all feeling pretty down at that point. And we'd kind of given up on the idea of having European football, which obviously adds money to the coffers. It's another game to enjoy once a week. And it gives us an opportunity to blood some young players. So he's done what he needs to do. There's two kind of schools of thought on it. There's a school of thought that says, you know, he's ground out the results because that's what he needs to do. And there's a school of thought that says, this is just Mourinho's style. And these are the results you get with Mourinho's style. Either way, it's got the job done for now. And if he were to walk away tomorrow, then we can say that he had a successful tenure, can't we?
Yeah.
There was an interesting tweet about this, and it goes back to what you were saying about your spreadsheet. So it was very tongue in cheek, but it was M4 tweeted, sorry, it's THFC underscore M4. He tweeted, Jose Mourinho took Tottenham from 3 points off fifth to 3 points off fifth. Serial winner. Which does kind of miss, it kind of misses the concept of arithmetic, but the points per game reality is very different to the literal 3 points off fifth reality. And so that's where your spreadsheet comes in handy, Nathan.
You're welcome, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, what do your projections show in terms of had Mourinho had us all season?
So if you look at all of Mourinho's games, he's hitting 1.7 points per game, which over a season works out to about 66 points, which is sort of fifth pushing fourth, maybe. I think, in a typical season. Obviously, this was not a typical season. If you look at just post-lockdown games, and he's hitting 2 points a game, which is 76-point season. That's fourth or third, I think, in a typical season. The thing with that, though, is that our expected points throughout the season, you know, whether under Pochettino, whether under Mourinho, whether before lockdown, whether after lockdown, is that we've consistently been hitting 1.3 expected points per game, which averages out to about 50 points a season. I would say that specifically with the way that we've played post-lockdown is that we've scored from our first chance, sat back, and allowed the opposition to litter us with long distance shots. And that's why I need to explain what expected points are, don't I? So expected points is like a share of 3 points, like down to two decimal places, based on the probability of who was most likely to win the game based on the expected goals created by both sides, right? So if you take, for example, the Palace game, we created 0.3 expected goals, right? Again, we essentially scored our first chance. We turned the ball over high up the pitch. Lo Celso fed the ball to Kane. Kane brilliantly bounced it between his feet. Just incredible bit of athleticism. It brought so much joy to me. And that was basically it. Right, after that we sat back and Palace littered with shots that largely bounced into shins. Obviously they got Schlupp's shot from a corner, which is 0.5. They totaled essentially one expected goal. They hit theirs, right? So this gives us So it gives Palace 2.05 expected points and gives us 0.62 expected points, right? So that would suggest that Palace were unlucky. But I think if you look at the way we've played this game and several others like it in the last few weeks, we've scored from our first chance and set back, and that's really warped the statistics. Now, what you could say is that we've been really lucky with how we've scored that first chance. And then in future, we're going to have to create 2, 3, 4, 5 chances before we get that first goal. I would also say what I really expect, the improvement if we carry on down this line, is that we're going to get better on the counter-attack and we're going to punish teams more for coming forward, and we're going to continue to create chances after our first goal, because we're going to, like we saw Arsenal is the example so far, is that we're going to become horrible to go forward against, and yeah, more like the North London derby game.
Interesting. So the expected points system is slightly flawed.
Oh, it's very flawed. It's, yeah. But I really like it. I think it's useful over the course of maybe a season.
That's what I was going to come on to. Yeah. Yeah. So you'd expect it across a season to be roughly right. But Mourinho is trolling the expected points system as it stands with his play style. But I mean, that's what you've described his play style as being like from the very beginning of his tenure. You said that he likes to manipulate the scoreline. He likes to get ahead first, and then he can do what he likes to do, which is, well, he's got two options if we're ahead, and that gives him greater capacity to manage the team in the way he sees fit at the time. And like you say, the best case scenario is we get better at counter-attacking and we see more of that Arsenal game. The worst case scenario is we don't get the first goal very often and we become very, very painful on the eye as we try and break down a set defence with a team that's not set up to play possession football and doesn't even have the right personnel to do so. So, swings and roundabouts.
But that's what we saw, you know, against Everton, Bournemouth.
And Crystal Palace. Except we scored first against Palace.
Yeah, yeah.
With a bit of luck, arguably. Have you adjusted to watching Mourinho ball?
In that, like, I expect it.
Yeah.
In that, like, I know to wait for the moments and listen when there's, like, a bit of excitement. Watch when there's a bit of excitement in with the commentator or whatever. And accept that there are going to be phases where I pay little attention. And try to sort of, yeah, follow the game from a bit more of a distance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's exactly the same as how I feel. It's not what I want from a football club, but it's not the end of the world. It's fine. And I think next year, as long as we kind of use young players in the Europa League, there's going to be some excitement there, because you might be seeing the next Harry Kane. That's exciting, right? Like, that's something to genuinely look forward to. We're going to see hopefully some players that we wouldn't otherwise see, because Mourinho's already said he likes to use young players in the Europa League. That could lead to another huge talent coming through our academy, which is great news. And I look forward to that happening. So the other thing that was notable about the Crystal Palace match was that it was Jan Vertonghen's last appearance in a Spurs shirt. I thought it was a real pity that he didn't get on the pitch. I know the crowd wasn't there, so it kind of made it less of an issue. But we brought on a centre back for the last couple of minutes. Like, I was a bit like, why couldn't it just be Vertonghen, just to give him one last run out? But sad times. See the end of Jan Vertonghen as a Spurs player. I really warmed to him over his time with Spurs, and the video that the club released of him, where other players were talking about the impact he's had on their careers and in the dressing room, just showed what an important figure he's been for these, what, 8 years? I think it's 8 years. I think he's the best kind of ball-playing defender that we've had in my lifetime. I would say Ledley King would come close in terms of his technique. Alderweireld, certainly in terms of his passing. But in terms of pure dribbling ability and skill with the football at its feet, I think Vertonghen's number one.
Of course.
The Vertonghen and Alderweireld partnership is certainly the best centre-back pairing that I've seen at Spurs.
Yeah.
Anything you'd like to add about Jan Vertonghen, Nath?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I really like Vertonghen. I very much warm to, like, his grumpiness that I think some people is turned off by, but I really like the honesty of it and the character of it, and that he will, like, you know, he'll shrug with an annoyed look on his face when things aren't going right, if he feels like another player has let him down, because, I don't know, it's less robotic, it's more real, and I don't know, I just like that about him. I found him a very interesting character, and also a brilliant, brilliant footballer, of course. sort of stuck between centre back and left back at times, which I understand that he was frustrated by. Obviously, when people talk about his best performances, they're going to mention Dortmund last season where he played at wing back, which I guess says a lot about his game and his abilities from a centre back position. But it's consistency over years, and still being a good player when things were bad, and then stepping up to being a great player when things improved at the club. I think playing on the left of a back three was probably his best spell.
Yeah.
Because that really allowed him to be adventurous with his running. Being the third man, we used to play a thing where we would do a switch in the deepest area and he would become the free man and get to surge forwards with the ball at his feet, which I really enjoyed. He used to do some... he did it a couple of times under Villas-Boas as well in a back two. I remember him combining with Bale against Swansea. Yeah. He had a strangely good partnership with a forward for a while that season. A really brilliant player, and for me at least, a really likeable character.
I will really miss that Jan Vertonghen drop of the shoulder and step into midfield.
Yeah, man.
Where he would nearly always find a useful pass forward. He's been great, a fantastic servant, and we're really going to miss him. We're really going to miss him. And it seems like Mourinho has set on Eric Dier as the long-term replacement. I mean, I was surprised, actually, that Dier played this game against Palace. I thought that Sanchez would get another match. Did that surprise you, Nate?
It didn't surprise me. I feel like I'm the only person who's not surprised. Tell me why you're surprised.
Just because I thought Sanchez had had a good run of games, and it was the last game of the season. They didn't feel like any particular need to change things up.
But Dier signed a new deal, and there's been this big thing of Dier being like a first choice centre back, and Dier started the post lockdown, and he's been in decent form, and you know he's Mourinho's boy.
As much as that says nice things to Eric Dier and probably makes him feel very happy, it can't be great for Davinson Sanchez. I can't imagine he's feeling too...
I think you just accept that, like, you're the third... Like, has he ever been our, like, first choice... One of our first choice centre-backs?
With Vertonghen leaving, maybe he's thinking, finally, this is my time. I get to shine.
Okay, all right.
And now he's behind someone who's moved position.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
It just felt a little bit unnecessary. But then at the same time, Dier played really well and has played well, and apparently is incredibly vocal and really helpful in organising the backline. So for all of those reasons, I get it, but... I'm surprised.
I say this every time we bring up Davinson Sanchez. He is 24. Like, he's a baby in centre-back terms still.
I'm not sure that's I don't think that's a baby.
Well, he's a teenager. I don't know. He's pre-peak.
I do have long-term concerns about Davinson Sanchez, to be honest. I feel brave enough to say this without Bardi here, because Bardi loves Davinson Sanchez so much. He thinks he's fantastic. He thinks he's, like, one of our better players. I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth, and sees him as a long-term centre-back for Spurs. I don't, to be honest. I thought he played really well in the season when he first came and played lots, normally in the back three, if I remember correctly. I don't think he's quite developed as we would have hoped. He was not a cheap centre-back signing.
That's
I think
true.
It was like 40 million either euros or pounds.
He broke our transfer record at the time.
Yeah.
So on that basis...
If we got an offer of 40 million for him now, like, they would definitely sell, right?
I guess so.
And he might find himself further down the pecking order if we sign Kim. I don't know. We'll see. We shall see. Speaking of Bardi, we will do a season wrap-up once Bardi's back. And I'm sure Bardi wants to talk about Jan Vertonghen too. He needs to have an opportunity to show some love to Jan. We're also expecting the All or Nothing Amazon show to drop probably mid-August. And we'll do some podcasts around that too. But to finish off today, we'll just do some questions.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
So starting off with one from Javad Motherheady. He says, is it such a bad thing if a young player with talent doesn't get game time on loan? And he specifically references Phil Foden, where he says, Pep felt it was best for his development to stay, and sure enough, he seems to be slowly getting his chances and taking them. What do you think, Nathan? Do you have opinions on this either way?
You know, I mean, every time Foden's going to come up, Sancho's going to come up. Same age group, same club, same country, same breakout under 17 World Cup moment. Sancho in the middle of, or just before that tournament, had moved to Dortmund. Foden remained at City. Sancho is, in talks for like an £80 million move. Foden is just breaking through now. I'm not Pep Guardiola. I don't train with Foden. I don't have, I don't have any coaching experience. Guardiola might be the best coach in the world. With all of that said, I don't see the ways in which Foden is better now than he was 2 years ago, and why he couldn't have started playing, 20 minutes back then, starting the occasional game back then, starting consistent cup games back then. Yes, patience has worked out for Foden in that he is now beginning to break through in one of the best teams in the world. He's still very young, even though he wasn't as young as he was before. Yes, patience has worked out, but I don't think it's helped. I struggle to believe it's helped develop him in that time. I don't think he's much different than he was before.
No, and I'm sure if you asked him, he would say that he's different. He is different as a person, of course, because you're different at 20 to how you are at 17. Like, that's sure. That's just a fact. You grow up, right? It's not unusual. But it's not unusual to be a much more rounded person at 20 to what you were in your late teens. I think that's normal.
Of course.
And I think every case is person specific. I think there might be some players that need to go on loan because you're worried about their immaturity and they need to learn what it's like to kind of live away from being coddled or whatever, and tested against like the brutes that you get in League Two or whatever. And I think that's had some positive effects for some Spurs players over the years. I'm thinking back to Ryan Mason and Stephen Caulker and Andros Townsend all going down to Yeovil together and rooming together, and they learnt a lot about what it's like to live alone and train with actual men whose careers depend on this game once a week. I think there's something to be said about that, and it's a bit different for Foden because in some ways he had a career path defined for him, which was you learn from David Silva, and when David Silva leaves, you take his place. Not every young player is lucky enough to have that. Not every young player has got a defined career path with a manager that says, if you carry on doing these things, you will be here by this time. And they do all have performance plans, I'm sure, and development plans, and they'll each have their specific KPIs to meet. Every young player will. But they're not going to be as lucky as Foden is to have a clear pathway to the first team. And obviously for Sancho, he couldn't see that pathway. He thought, my pathway is better if I move to a club that's going to play me now rather than the club that might play me in 3 years, which I completely respect and understand and admire him for doing. I personally think that playing is better than not playing, regardless of anything else, regardless of training with the first team. The only example I can think of a player at Spurs who stayed around and then got games was Harry Winks. Every other player has needed to go on loan to get regular games. Some of them have got fed up of not being sent on loan and have left. The likes of Edwards, for example. Keenan Bennett's another one. And people will come back and say, well, the fact that only Edwards is doing well of all of our youngsters shows that we were making the right decisions and it wasn't a problem that they were leaving. And I'm like, well, development's not linear. We don't know what would have happened if things had taken a different path, if people had different exposure at different ages. So it's not possible to make that argument now. But basically, there's more than one way to skin a cat. But generally, I think playing is better than not playing.
Sure. And like, patience and not playing hasn't been much of a hindrance for Foden. He's given up a couple of years that he can happily afford at the beginning of his career, and he's getting through now, whereas for other players that would have been very, very destructive. And there are a lot of players who things haven't worked out for with that sort of 2 years of waiting around.
Definitely. I also think Foden is an unusually mature decision maker on the pitch.
Yeah, 100%. His playing is so beyond his years. Extremely.
So perhaps it wasn't so vital for him to go out and iron out mistakes because he can just step in with limited minutes under his belt. Maybe there's something in that, but I still think we're being quite generous to Pep if we say that. I think it's been quite selfish of Guardiola to hold on to Foden just to give him a few minutes here and there over the last 2 years. And I think if he'd had gone on loan to like a German Bundesliga team or a championship club, I think he'd be a much better player now. That's not to say he's not brilliant now, because he really is. He's a fantastic young player. And I think he's going to be a star next season when he gets proper minutes. Another question from Javad. He says, do you think there is any chance that Kyle Walker-Peters will come back to Spurs?
Yes, I wouldn't completely rule it out. I think Mourinho is toying with the idea at least, or at least wants to pretend that's the case to get more of a fee out of Southampton. I'm looking at putting together maybe a video piece on Walker-Peters looking at his time in Southampton. They're interested in him. And if a good Premier League team are interested in your player, you should have a think about holding on to that player, you know? I don't know. Maybe it depends on, you know, because he did the Foden thing. He waited around for 2 years. He rode the bench week after week after week after week after week. He signed new contracts. He got promises of play times. He played 3 cup games or whatever. And things just continued in that frustrating direction. And now he's got a taste of football. He might stick, you know, he might say, I don't want to risk just being back on the bench again. Even if Spurs seem more interested in me now than they were before, he might say, I've got assurances of playtime at Southampton. So I guess if that's the way he feels, then there's not a lot we can do to persuade him. But I think from a Spurs perspective, he's, you know, we need a right back. He's a right back.
Yeah. I mean, if he's taking advice from people who know football, I'm sure they'll be telling him that you are much more suited to a Ralf Hasenhüttl side than you are to a Jose Mourinho side, to be honest. I think he's a really good fit for Southampton. Their fans love him because he's been putting in kind of up and down the wing style performances, where he kind of sometimes drifts into midfield like he used to do for our under-18s and kind of almost dictates tempo from midfield, which is so unusual for a fullback. But he does it really effectively. He's a very clever user of the ball in those midfield areas. And I think he will do really well if he stays in Southampton. I'm not so convinced he would do well if he comes back to Spurs. But then it could depend on what you said earlier, Nathan. Does Mourinho want to change tack with our fullbacks? Does he want to try something different? Or, I don't know, he's certainly a very different player to Serge Aurier. Aurier is much more physically robust, able to take hits. He's better in the air.
He's got a bicycle kick aerial clearance in his locker.
Yes, he has that. I think Walker-Peters is a better user of the ball. I think he's much better at hitting the byline. I think he's really good at cutbacks. Don't think he's as good at crossing from deep. If our fullbacks are there to cross from deep, then keep Aurier. A lot depends on what Mourinho wants. But at the moment, Walker-Peters could be the key to getting one of our main transfer deals done this window, and that is signing Højbjerg. If Southampton demand Walker-Peters in exchange, then I suspect he will go in exchange, and that'll be that. Joe Gilby emailed us. He said, I'm wondering why exactly Tottenham signed Ndombele. On the surface, it makes sense, an incredibly talented midfielder who could open up a team in a second. But the more I take a step back and look at the cold light of day, it doesn't make much sense. Ndombele is somewhat of a luxury midfielder, when in a post-Ndombele era, we are crying out for an industrious unit of a midfielder, which Tongi is not. I wonder if the club, in trying to replace Ndombele and Eriksen, tried to kill two birds with one stone, but instead have now been left with just one big lump of stone who does not seem to fit our system at all. What do you think to that, Nathan?
Yeah, no, I think we were expecting him to be much more industrious than he has been. I think that he was much more more industrious in Ligue 1 than he's given us so far. Whether that is a result of, I don't know, a change in attitudes based on, you know, oh well, I've got my big contract at my big club, so I'll stop trying. I doubt that. Or whether it's, you know, an injury thing, the tooth issue thing, whether he's just been upset with the circumstances, whether it's that the Premier League is more demanding, that he's been a slightly, he's been a quite different player here than he was there. But I think that the signing made a huge amount of sense at the time. You know, we needed for Pochettino to replace Moussa Dembélé with a player who was like him, a ball carrier, a ball progressor, a mercurial talent, and a pressing resister. And then Dembélé was all of those things. It hasn't worked out so far, but the best time to judge when a transfer is the information that was available at the time. And I stand by that it was a good decision based on what we knew and who he was and the conditions at the club at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's all of those things that you mentioned. It's the injury, it's the Premier League being a bit more intense than expected, it's him being upset at the lack of play time, it's everything. And if we're willing to make excuses for Mourinho, like, you know, the squad's unbalanced, he's had injuries, he's had suspensions, he's had coronavirus, then we need to make those same excuses for Ndombele and give him just as much of a clean slate. I still think he's one of our best players. I appreciate that he's not shown that on a regular basis, but I think the glimpses we saw at the beginning of the season, and some of the glimpses we saw in cameos later as well, show that he is a supremely talented player. And I think it's really important that we try to get the best out of that talent rather than giving up on it, because I don't think we're going to sign another midfielder as good as Ndombele anytime soon. And it would be such a pity to lose one of the most coveted central midfielders in the world because of what? A falling out, maybe? I don't know. It just seems too little to give up on him on. And I think we've got to try and persist and get what we can out of him because he's brilliant and he can be brilliant. Ben Bowman says, Pochettino said Spurs needed a painful rebuild. Now he, Dembele, Eriksen, Vertonghen and Rose are gone. For you, who else goes? Which that remain in terms of the character are the heart of the new Spurs? So what do you think, Nathan? Who for you would remain and be the heart of Spurs now?
Lo Celso, Kane, Son and Dembele. New defensive midfielder. I guess Eric Dier.
Wow.
You know,
who would have thought you'd be saying that 3 months ago?
Well, that's just the direction of the team. You know, who goes though? Sissoko. I would get rid of Lucas, but that seems unlikely. I would terminate Jensen's loan.
That is absolutely savage, mate.
No, but just like, okay, the reason we brought Jensen in, as far as I can tell, was because Sissoko got injured when we desperately needed him. So we got a player who was a bit like him to come in and, you know, be in his place while he was injured. And then by the time, you know, then football immediately went on a break. And by the time it was back, Sissoko was back. So but I guess, like, you wait until the end of the window because, like, you want to see how you filled midfield places and how Ndombele is getting along and stuff. But if things go well in the transfer window, I don't get what Jensen brings us. And like,
yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. Nathan the Terminator Clark is absolutely right. All Jensen will do is stand between Harvey White getting a first team debut. And I'd rather put faith in our own homegrown players. I mean, the thing about Jensen is he's a freebie on the player registration list for the next year. Can probably cover a couple of positions.
Okay.
And we're probably keeping a super agent somewhere sweet.
I would want to hire a lawyer full time, and all he does every day is he reads Jensen's pre-sale contract over and over again to make sure that we never ever trigger any of the conditions that mean that we have to pay lots of money to sign him permanently.
Was it like 40 million?
I think it was like looking at that kind of sum of money. Yeah.
They must have been cackling as they wrote that into the contract,
which is why I also suspect there's a clause written in Portuguese that says if he spends more than 71 minutes on the pitch on more than 7 occasions, then the, you know, whatever, then the clause is triggered and the transfer is permanent.
Please no. Please God no. I mean, he's not awful, but he's just nothing special. And there's nothing to say that he can't develop into a good player, but let's not be the guinea pigs, right? If we're not going to be the guinea pigs for our own young players, let's not be the guinea pig for someone else's. It seems silly to me. So I think in terms of their character and the heart of Spurs, it's the spine, isn't it? It's Alderweireld, it's Kane, it's Lo Celso, it's definitely Son. I absolutely adore that man. I think he brings me so much happiness in terms of watching football. How do you feel about Lloris now?
Pretty positively.
He's had a really, really good spell post-lockdown.
Yeah. Oh, I had a question that I forgot to forward. So Charles sent me some of his saves versus post-shot expected goal data. So post-shot expected goal. So normally when we look at a shot to measure the likelihood of it going in, we look at like where the shot was taken, how many defenders are in the way, what foot it's taken on, whether it came from a pass or a dribble, etc, etc, etc. Post-shot, we look at where the ball is hit to. Is it wide? Is it central? Is it right in the corners of the goal? Is it right in the corner and low where it's hardest to save? That kind of information. And consistently, year after year after year, Lloris has been one of the best shot stoppers in terms of all analytical measurement that we can possibly put together, essentially his entire Tottenham career. So I remember at the beginning of the 2018-19 season, he was going through a rough spell. He made several like major errors within a couple of months period, and giving the ball away with his feet, completely fluffing crosses, chucked the ball into his net a couple of times. And then obviously like Brighton, you know, obliterated his elbow, throwing the ball into his own net. I remember back then, Mike Goodman wrote a piece defending him because Spurs fans were giving him a lot of hard time. And essentially Mike's piece was entirely on his post-shot data, that he was like consistently one of the best in the world, like top five every year for years in terms of his shot stopping. And I think it's easy for us to forget that, you know. He does have these flaws in his game. We're seeing less of them recently because there are defenders in the box to grab his crosses, and that he's not being asked to pass the ball anywhere but way up into the air. But his shot stopping is absurd still, and probably will be for a little while longer. A new goalkeeper is way down the priority list. I do think it's something that we should be thinking about all the time. But, you know, the Reese's ability to get in the way of the net is absolutely incredible. And I just think that it's so easy to forget that when we're used to him. And I think that like Gazzaniga and Vorm and everyone else gets a huge amount of scrutiny and are portrayed as like horrific shot stoppers, but they're not. They just seem that way compared to Lloris.
You're so right. And I've been very guilty of this myself. I think when Lloris makes an error, he really makes an error.
He looks bad, doesn't he?
It doesn't do him any favours. But it's wrong to sort of haul him over the coals every time he makes a high profile error, when actually he's sometimes saving us in the same match.
100%.
Regularly saving us in the same match.
Yeah.
In fact, I want to make a public apology to Hugo Lloris. I'm sorry, Hugo. I should never have doubted you. I should have looked at the data, and I was wrong, and you're a brilliant goalkeeper. Please don't drink and drive ever again. absolutely, we've got our goalkeeper for, let's say, 2 years minimum, hopefully longer. And, you know, just one less problem to deal with in the squad is really helpful right now, because we've got some serious holes to fix. And if we add goalkeeper to that as well, it becomes problematic. I agree with what you're saying in terms of we need to be looking for the replacement, the long-term replacement. That's really difficult, because not many goalkeepers are going to come and join a club where Hugo Lloris is first-choice goalkeeper because he's really good. So you're kind of having to keep irons in the fire, I guess, and watch to make sure you don't lose out on that player you've decided you like, because another club whose goalkeeper is just about to leave can jump in and promise them 38 games a season. That's problematic. Vorm leaving is an interesting one, because it opens up that third goalkeeper option, and I presume this time we'll keep it in-house. We'll use Whiteman or Austin next season for that.
Do you know how highly those two are sort of considered and rated? I know that goalkeepers aren't sort of your area.
No. I never feel comfortable rating goalkeepers. Of the two, From what I've seen, I much prefer Austin.
Okay.
But I get a feeling that the club prefer Whiteman. I don't know. That just comes from who seems to be prioritised when it comes to like being on the bench or being travelling with the first team.
So Austin's been out on loan, is that right?
Yes.
And Whiteman's been kept as our in-house emergency
Correct.
Youth keeper.
Correct, yeah. So, I mean, that could switch around next season. Perhaps if Austin's sure. grown out on loan and proved that he can play first-team football, then maybe he'll be trusted to be third choice and Whiteman goes out next year. In fact, I'd be all for that. I think that would be a sensible approach. But equally, I'd really like Austin to get another season out on loan, which, you know, then you're back down to the same problem. Do you sign a kind of experienced third-choice goalkeeper? It's not easy. It's not easy at all. Okay, one final question. This one is from Debaser92, who is a legend on
Twitter.
Shout
out to Jack.
Yeah, lovely, lovely man. He says, which players from Norwich, Bournemouth and Watford should we be interested in?
We did this before, but it was Villa instead of Watford. Let's have a look at Watford's squad real quick.
Well, so my thing with these three teams is that each of the team's best player is in a position we don't necessarily need. So
yes.
I'd say Norwich's best player is Buendia. Bournemouth's best player is David Brooks, and Watford's best player is Gerard Deulofeu.
That is correct.
I don't think we necessarily need any of those players. Deulofeu could perhaps do a job up top, as he has done for Watford at times this season, but I can't see us signing him. Buendia I really like, and I think if we didn't have Jose Mourinho as our manager, I think he would be a really good signing and would play lots of games, but I can't see us squeezing in another attacking midfielder in a Mourinho system. And David Brooks, again, like similar to Buendia, he's really good. He can play from the right, he can play in the middle, play behind a striker, but we've got enough players that can kind of do all those things already, so I don't see where he would fit in. Then you start looking at positions you can upgrade on, and the obvious one is Max Aarons can play right back better than Serge Aurier. I'm not hugely sold on Aarons, but I would agree that he's an upgrade on Aurier. Other than that, there's not a lot that I necessarily like. Would you take Troy Deeney or Callum Wilson as a backup striker?
Wilson is not completely beyond. I'll have a think about Wilson. Deeney is a no because he is 32. I'm looking through Watford squads and it is so old. Deeney 32, Kapu 32, Yamat 31, Dawson 30. So Saar is 22. If you know, we do like to look at wingers every window forever. And then like Nathaniel Chalobah is 25. Injury history, more of a passing defensive midfielder than a ball winning midfielder. Pereira's 29.
Jesus.
It's just like, yeah, I don't know.
They've really been caught with some players on big wages who are very old, haven't they? It's a bit of a mess of a squad.
There's a talent in this squad, but it is a nasty time to be relegated because now they have, just half their squads. Like, most of their squad is like over the age of 27 and expensive. That's it's going to be a tough time for Watford. If there are any Watford fans who occasionally listen to the Extra Inch, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
We're both apologising. I think I like Deeney a lot, not just as a player but as a character,
because he gives Arsenal a shit.
he does. I would urge anyone who's not listened to Troy Deeney on Louis Theroux's podcast that was released during lockdown. It's a fascinating listen. He's a brilliant person to listen to. He's incredibly articulate, honest, open, transparent, talks a lot about his upbringing and how that's made him the man he is now. And he talks openly about therapy as well, which is always interesting to hear a player from the world of football talk about therapy. But I think he'd be great in the dressing room, and I think he'd be the kind of player that Mourinho would like, actually. But he wouldn't suit Daniel Levy's transfer policy at all. So I think Levy wouldn't sign off on that one.
Nah.
Other than them, it's difficult to sort of see players that would have who would tangibly improve our squad. Jamal Lewis at Norwich is a good left back. Whether he's ready to come in and be better than Davis or Sessegnon, I doubt. And if we're going to sign a left back, it needs to be someone significantly better, I would say. But yeah, that's pretty much covered off those three. Nathan, I'm going to have to go now because I'm in quite a lot of pain.
Okay.
I'm suffering with potentially the same illness as Nathan, which is a bit weird, isn't it?
Podcast contagible.
Hernia brothers. Yeah. So I'm going to log off now. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back soon to do a season review with Bardi.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch.
Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at DavyShambles and his SoundCloud, D. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.